Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So what's going on in conservative America? For many Democrats and many political activists on all sides of the spectrum, this has been a question many people have been debating since the November election and even longer than that. But certainly the tenor of conservatism, the issues that matter to the right, and obviously the ultimate victor in the election raised many questions about what exactly was going on in the American heartland, which some felt they had not fully understood. And there were many Republicans as well, including candidates who fell to Donald Trump in the presidential primaries, who expressed some of this thought. There were parts of the country where there was a sense of anger and frustration and fury that led many voters to go for a candidate who defied political convention and expressed a shared sense of frustration about what is going on in our economy and the cultural values that some in the nation embrace. And understanding the modern conservative electorate seems to be one of the biggest tasks at hand today. Today we have with us a very distinguished scholar, Arlie Russell Hochschild, a sociologist at the University of California at Berkeley, and the author of many well-known books, including her most recent book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning of the American Right, which was a national book award finalist and has generated a lot of discussion. Three of her books have been named as New York Times notable books. She's received many grants and awards, and it's really an honor to have you with us today on the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
So maybe we could just start before we get into the substance of the book. Perhaps you could just tell us a little bit more about when and how you decided to write it and what drove you to this subject.
5 years ago, I was in my office in the sociology department here at UC Berkeley, and I realized that with Congress already then at a gridlock and rhetoric across the partisan lines escalating, that many of the things that I've always cared about just weren't going to happen anytime soon. And I realized that I was in a bubble. You know, I was in a geographic bubble, in a media bubble, in an electronic bubble, and that I had to get out of that bubble, find a place that was as far right as Berkeley, UC Berkeley, in the city of Berkeley, in California was to the left. And the project was to take my own political and moral alarm system off, to permit myself a great deal of curiosity and interest in those with whom I knew I had profound differences, and to cross what I came to call an empathy wall, so I could kind of stand in the shoes of people I knew I differed from. And that took me to the South, because that's where the right had grown the most strongly, and to the Super South. Louisiana and Mississippi are the Super South. I looked at the 2012 proportion of whites voting for Obama, and in the whole of the South as a whole region, it was 30%, and in Louisiana it was 14%. So I thought, okay, the Super South. And I brought to it a kind of a red state paradox. You know, how could it be that across the nation, it's the poorest states, the states with the worst education, the worst health care, the worst health, the most disrupted families, and the lowest life expectancy, the most pollution, also are the states that receive more money in aid from the federal government than they give to it in tax dollars, and also most revile the federal government. That was the paradox. How, if you've got all these problems, wouldn't you want some help? And Louisiana turned out to be an exaggerated version of the red state paradox, as the second poorest state had all those troubling rates, but 44% of the state budget came from the federal government, and it was overwhelmingly right-wing, very enthusiastic about the Tea Party, and they went very enthusiastically for Donald Trump. So that was an exaggerated version. That's the question I went in with.
And so, you picked, first you wanted to understand the other side or people with a different perspective and this red state paradox, and so you chose Louisiana, and then how did you go about doing the research? Were you interviewing people? Were you living in the community, or how did you put this together?
Yeah, well, I knew one person in the entire state, and she happened to be the mother-in-law of a former graduate student of mine. And her best friend, she was progressive, an artist, but her best friend was a very enthusiastic Tea Party embracer. And they were best friends. They had keys to each other's houses and went on cultural events together. Their children knew each other. So I started there. And they helped me set up a whole group of focus groups of progressives on one side and Tea Party enthusiasts on the other. And so I started there getting a sense of things. And then one of them invited me to meetings of Republican women of Southwest Louisiana. I started going to those. And everywhere I went, I told them exactly who I was. I'm doing a book on this. And from that, I would interview people around the table at the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana. And one of those people around the table that I made a date to interview happened to be a gospel singer in a Pentecostal church. So she took me there, and I began actually going to a lot of churches that way. So this was the way, ethnographic snowballing, we call it, that I started in Lake Charles. But I also followed a Republican candidate and his Tea Party rival as they whistle-stopped their way across the bottom of the foot of Louisiana. And so that took me to union meet and greets and Miss Rice festivals and boat parades and Cajun pig roasts. So that was another strategy. And then I began to realize that the big heart, the key of this red state paradox was in the environment. It was a highly, highly polluted environment as a petrochemical center of development. They very proudly call themselves the buckle in America's energy belt. And very high rate of pollution. I noticed my eyes would sting when I got in my car and crossed the I-10 bridge into Westlake. Eyes would sting. I couldn't see the sky. Everybody had bottled water. And so I looked that up, EPA data. It turns out to be the 2% most polluted counties in the country.
That was interesting in your book.
Polluters. Yeah.
That was interesting in your book because I picked it up beginning wanting to know about white resentment, wanting to know about exactly how people felt politically, where their beliefs came from. And then I encountered this quite a lot of coverage about the state of the Louisiana environment. I learned more about a company called Texas Brine than I was really expecting to learn. And so to what extent did it become about environmental conditions? Because that doesn't strike me as an immediately obvious aspect of this story.
Right. And the reason I chose focus on the environment was, number one, it seemed to be talking to me. Number two, the people I was getting to know, and I interviewed 60 people over those 5 years getting to know them, some of them really well, they didn't like this pollution, but they were living with them and with a very high cancer rate. Louisiana's the second highest death rate from cancer for men in the country. And so they were living with this paradox, and it it answered the self-interest question. Because you could say, well, two right-wing people who work hard have got a middle-class way of life. Hey, they're not using Medicaid. And they could say, oh, look, I'm not on Medicaid. I don't want to pay taxes for it. I'm for the Tea Party. It wouldn't be in their interest, therefore, to support those welfare programs. You could say that that accounts for the difference, but you can't say that about the environment. Everybody wants to breathe clean air, and they want to be able to swim in clean waterways. And clearly that was true for the people I talked to, but they were not voting for candidates who would regulate the polluters. So I thought, okay, this is the real key. This is it, it's in your self-interest to live with clean energy and clean, clean environment. And yet people weren't voting that way. So I thought, this is the thing I really want to understand that is puzzling to me.
And did they, you talked to them about this, when you asked them about or heard them about these kinds of issues, do they think of this as part of their own interest? Do they agree with what you're saying, or do they see it differently?
No, they agreed that they wanted a clean environment. No one told me I like it dirty. No. But people responded in three kinds of ways, and I describe each of them in the book. Mm-hmm. One of them would be what I call the company loyalist, mm-hmm. party loyalist. And she would say, well, look, it's not so bad. And, you know, we can handle it. And my party, the Republican Party, doesn't want to regulate the polluters. We think our bread and butter depends on jobs from the Petros, and we'll go along with it. We'll, whatever the party says, that would be one kind of response. Another was almost a more religious response. Say, well, no, it is dirty. This environment is really dirty, and my next-door neighbor's 11-year-old just got a rare brain cancer. I think it's from the chemicals around here, and that's terrible. I don't like it. But we don't always get what we want, and pollution is the price we pay for capitalism. So she saw the problem, but she renounced her desire to solve it, and almost as a sacrifice, religious sacrifice. So that was the second response I found. And the third I came to call the cowboy response, where people would say, well, look, I'm tough, you're tough, Mother Nature's tough, there's not a problem here. People think there is, maybe there's a little bit, but we're tough mm-hmm. and we can withstand it. So these were all different, as I see them, kind of emotional pathways to accommodation to a high degree of pollution.
So, Arlie Hochschild, in your book, Strangers in Their Own Land, one thing I notice here in this discussion, this description you're making of people here, is that I'm curious about how they view people who are outside their group. And so you are watching them and getting to know them, but they're also talking with you about people who are outside the South. And in your book, you write about line cutters. And I just wanted to get a little feeling from you about when they talk about liberals, when they talk about the broader culture, what is it that they see when they look out at the world that's outside Louisiana?
Right. First of all, they feel looked down on. They watch television. They are keenly interested in how others see them. They're not an insulated group. They'll channel flip and see what MSNBC is saying about people from the South. And one woman said to me, well, we're the flyover state, and we know that liberals think we're backward and uneducated and racist and homophobic and
Did she use those words?
Yes.
Because homophobic strikes me as a liberal word.
It is a liberal word, and that's the word she used. So she was looking over, you know, the shoulders of the South to kind of see how she was looked at. Yeah. They're keenly aware, and they feel marginalized.
Okay, but But part of that is, okay, so what? So you got firsthand a big dose of that. So you show up there, fancy professor.
Who I am.
So there you are, fancy, famous professor, Berkeley intellectual, famous sociologist. You probably didn't tell them I'm a famous sociologist, but there you are. Did they get curious about what it was like meeting a real live egghead Berkeley liberal? I mean, did that come up in an explicit way?
You know, I didn't get a lot of questions back.
Really?
And part of that is cultural. They have their folk way is to kind of wait and see how you manifest yourself. After 5 years, I was talking with a woman and said, well, I know, you don't like the fried food, you know, you always see or you're a polite sort of person, you know, or you're a positive person. She would pick out things that where I'd shown my character, but she wouldn't ask, a lot about me. I did get asked, well, you know, how long have you been married to your husband? And how does he think about you coming here? I brought my husband on.
By yourself? You mean they're asking, how does he feel about you coming all the way here to the South by yourself?
That's right. And I would say, oh, he's 100% behind it. He loves this project. In fact, I brought him last month. Yeah, but they weren't as curious about me as I was about them.
Well, I guess for you, the ethnographic method as a professional, your job is to, I suppose, not make it about you unless it becomes some explicit part of the conversation.
You know, exactly that came out in one conversation I had with a gospel singer. And I was meeting her at the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana monthly meeting, and she said, oh, I love Rush Limbaugh, you know, the conservative radio commentator. And
My brave heart.
Yes, my brave heart, exactly. And so we met for sweet teas soon after, and I'm asking her about this, and she's saying, oh, I love him because he says feminists are feminazis, right? And environmentalists are environmental wackos. And she's watching my face, and I'm just trying to be neutral. I really do have my alarm system off. I'm listening, and I'm, well, what is a feminazi, you know, and what is an environmental wacko? Tell me about that. And she later, I went to a gumbo cook-off, and we met again for sweet teas. And she said, was that hard for you to hear what I said? I know you don't agree with me. And I told her, you know, not at all. The reason I'm here is not to tell you about me. I already know about me, but what I don't understand is you, and you're doing me an enormous favor to share your views and your life. And I can't tell you, I appreciate that. And she said, you know, taking your alarm system off, I do that too. I can do that. And then we had that in common, see. So she got what I was doing. And she, you know, invited me to the church. I could interview anyone in the church. She took me to playing cards. There's a special cards game called Rook that evangelicals especially like, and so she taught that. So it was like that. She wanted to get the hang of what I was doing and could relate to it. And then she said, you know, to tell you the truth, what Rush Limbaugh really does is protect me from the epithets that I feel are coming from people like you. You know, he's protective, and he's, you know, the liberals are saying you're racist and homophobic and so on. He's putting them back in their place. Now, so I learned a lot. Yeah.
We mentioned the waiting in line briefly, and that comes in a chapter 9 where you talk about the deep story. And you write about, I was learning about the Bayou and factory childhoods and the larger context, industry, state, church, regular media, Fox News, of all the lives of those I had come to know, lay, I realized, a deep story. A deep story is a feels-as-if story. It's the story feelings tell in the language of symbols. And you go on, can you tell us a little more about what a deep story is, both in this context, but even more broadly, what you're trying to tell us through this book about how these deep stories work?
A deep story, as you just said, is a feels as if it's real story. You take facts out of the deep story. You take moral judgments out of the deep story. It's just what feels true. And I posit in the book that we all have a deep story. There's a right-wing deep story and there's a left-wing deep story. And but my interest is in the right-wing deep story, which goes like this. You can tell it in this way. You're standing in line, as in a pilgrimage, facing to the top of the hill at which you see the American dream. And your feet are tired. They're pointed to this goal. You feel a great sense of deserving. And the line hasn't moved for a very long time. One character that I feature in the book, very typical of others, said, oh, I haven't had a raise in 2 decades. And as for vacations, oh, last place I worked at for the first 5 years, I got 1 week vacation, sick time together. Next 5 years, I got 2 weeks off. It loves to fish, can't get the time to get out there. So he's waiting in line with great sense of deserving and entitlement. And then the next moment in the right-wing deep story, he sees somebody cutting in line. Well, who would that be? That would be blacks who, through federally mandated affirmative action programs, finally have access to jobs that have been reserved for whites. And then, from his point of view, even worse, women step in line ahead of him and through federally mandated affirmative action, and they now have access to jobs always reserved for men, and then immigrants, and then refugees, and all these line cutters, as he sees them. It feels not fair. And then, in another moment of the right-wing deep story, there's Barack Obama, who should be impartially monitoring the line, the American people. He's waving to the line cutters. In fact, is he a line cutter? Many people ask me, how could a single mother, Barack Obama's mother, afford a Harvard education? Do you know how expensive that is? Must be something fishy. They couldn't imagine that an elite school has, you know, a full scholarship for brilliant students. No, that just didn't feel plausible to them. And so this was a line cutter president sponsoring other line cutters, cutting him and his people out. Yeah, so he felt put back.
So this deep story, so I'm just going to step back from it a little bit. So there's this intuition that people you met have about how things work in the country, line cutting, the way things are going, where these people, you know, these people taking things that where it's not their turn. How much of this is just looking at people who look different and looking at brown people and saying, well, you know, like, you can't possibly deserve this. So why is it that you're there on my TV screen talking at me? I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, there's another storyline is white people in Louisiana don't like to see a black guy in the White House.
What I'm giving you is the phenomenology of a right-wing worldview. I'm trying to take you inside how it looks. But once you are inside, you see racial categorization. You see sex categorization. You see it's there in the deep story. Why are these people in the line cutters in the more left liberal view? Wait a minute, that's a robot that's cutting in line. You know, automation is the big elephant in the room that we're not looking at. That's who's taking your good jobs away, you know, or offshoring. Right there in Lake Charles in Southwest Louisiana, too, the biggest company there, Sasol, was going to import Filipina pipe cutters, pipe fitters at a much lower rate. why that's between you and the American dream. Why aren't they looking at that? And why are they looking at people of different color and different gender? What I'm trying to convey is how it looks to them and account for their feeling. But yes, of course, this is, and I talk about it in the book, very much a question of perceptions of race, perceptions of gender.
Do they still believe in the American dream?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And they expect to be rescued for them by Donald Trump. But what they feel, one thing they really liked about Trump and really didn't like about Hillary Clinton was that he seemed to be taking on the pain they felt, the sense of decline they felt. Things were not well and had to be fixed. They related to that, whereas Hillary was telling a different story. She was saying, everything's fine, we're on our way, if you work hard, you know, a few fixes here and there, but the neoliberalism is really working for everyone. And they said, no, it isn't. It's not working for us. And these people were not the down and out. They weren't the really poor, mm-hmm. you know, who aren't voting. But they're kind of the elite of the left behind. And they felt they'd gotten part of the way up and were now on a decline. And they said, in a way, they said, look what's happened to blacks. Look what globalization did to them. You know, the union protected industrial jobs going out, leaving them devastated and their families a mess. Well, that's going to happen to us. We're next.
So when they look at liberal politicians, whether it be Elizabeth Warren, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, when they talk about these ideas that you were just talking about, do they dislike these people personally, or is it the ways that, say, let's take Clinton as an example, or do they dislike the ways that technocratic Democrats talk about their problems? So unpack a little bit how much of that is personal and how much of that is just the politician not getting it.
They love Bernie Sanders. Here are these people voting on the extreme right, you know, and if it hadn't been Trump, it would have been Cruz or Rubio. So they're very right-wing, but they like Bernie. Oh, Uncle Bernie, they would say. So they didn't agree. They would say, oh, he's, got unrealistic. He's an idealist. He's pie in the sky. You can't have free higher education for all Americans. It would sink the ship. But they liked that he was an outsider because they felt like outsiders too. And this talk about focus on policies without speaking to the pain they felt and the decline they feared. If you don't have a narrative that does that, they won't hear you.
A lot of politics, the way you describe it in this conversation in the book, is really about emotions. It's about narratives. It's about stories. It's about identifying as a party loyalist in some ways, or one of the other categories you discussed. Is that how you see or understand the electorate after the experience of writing this book?
Yes. I feel like globalization, free trade, and automation has created a kind of an economic geography that underlies the split we're facing. But that under that is a redistribution of honor, you know, and cultural appreciation to which emotions are deeply attached. And we haven't looked at that. And unless we really do, we're not going to be able to find common ground with the people who've peeled off in the direction of Trump and are holding on to him.
And how would we figure? I mean, I'm, as a lab scientist, I have the luxury of looking for arrows of causality where one thing causes another. And I'm hearing this emotional story about, you know, deep story about what it feels like to be a citizen of Louisiana and to be thinking about these things. But then there's the question of loss of jobs and loss of opportunities. So what's the causality? So just to make an analogy, if I'm a tadpole and I get put into a place where there aren't a whole lot of resources, then I might have, if tadpoles could think. I might develop some kind of deep story about what it was like having those other tadpoles take away my resources. So when we put this deep story into context, is it the consequence of these economic forces? Is it something that is that is prior to that? I'm trying to build a chain here of causation. I'm trying to figure that out. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know about tadpoles, but if you go to Louisiana with me one time and we go on a walk or a fishing trip, and some of the people that I met, you wouldn't find a tadpole. You would find a thinking person who's capable of ambivalence and trying to get the big picture, and someone you could really talk with about your disagreements. And you would find that they felt, if you keyed on feelings, they felt that they very much loved the way of life they had. So they didn't start thinking, oh, I'm going to scramble up to the American dream. They're thinking the American dream will bring me a bigger, better version of what I already have, and the whole world is going a different direction. They felt like a minority. And so they felt a fear that they would lose, an expectation that they would be on a losing side, and that all the trends were going against them. So they felt embattled, and they were surprised that, oh, wow, now it's the left liberals who were the strangers in their own land, and pleased at that.
I see.
But on feeling level, to get at feeling, I think, and this is what I would say to any lab scientist, to get at feeling, what we have to do is reconstruct the objective correlative of that feeling, what T.S. Eliot called, you know, all the tiny myriad million things that are true that make you feel the way you do. And that's what the deep story tries to do, try to evoke those so that you think, oh, yeah, I get how someone could. If you thought that was true, I can see how you got there.
Well, this isn't in your book, but I wanted to ask about the converse deep story. So if someone's in the left liberal bubble, what's their deep story?
Yeah.
What's the thing that defies political logic, the unconscious force that removes judgment, that I'm quoting you now? Removes judgment, yeah. It removes fact.
Yeah. I think in the left liberal deep story, we're all ranged around a public square. Many people all facing the center. And in this public square is a state-of-the-art children's science museum, free to children of all colors and every social class, and open long hours. There are public libraries and museums, and there's a bird sanctuary, and many public accomplishments. And people look at this and value it. It's not just a big government, it's a commons. And it's you have nonprofits that have made it, but it's the idea that you are rich or poor in common goods, that this is to be valued. And in then the left progressive liberal deep story, along comes a steam shovel and an excavator, and it begins to gouge out the concrete underneath that state-of-the-art creative children's science museum, destroy that museum, take it out behind the backs of the people facing the square, builds with that material a McMansion that only the 1% are going to get to live in. So privatization and the destruction of a public good, of the function of good government, that is angering to and alarming to the left liberal. I think that's the core of the deep story.
Does their deep story have a poor or false understanding of the communities that you've studied?
Yes, I think there are some illusions in the left liberal deep story. The government isn't always doing a creative, state-of-the-art job of providing. It's sometimes captured by private interests so that only certain people can benefit from public dollars. I don't think that's, I think it goes on, and people would say it goes on, but it's not in the left liberal deep story. So that's a source of illusion, I think.
And you finished writing the book. I can't remember. When did you finish, like, hand it into the publisher? Pre-election, post-election?
It was, I did not yet know. It was pre-election. I had gone to Donald Trump's primary rally and report that in the book and think, oh, you know, I have been studying the dry kindling, but now I see the match that's going to light it.
So you weren't totally maybe as surprised as the rest of your neighbors in Berkeley when the election went to him.
I was surprised, but not as surprised as they were.
Mm-hmm. So the book did change your perceptions or give you, as you intended when you set out on this journey, a better sense of parts of the electorate that you hadn't really understood before or you hadn't been close to.
That's right.
Do any of these people, you ever encounter any curiosity about them to come understand liberals, or do they think that they get it all out of their TV and they just see these, you know, various people looking down on them? Do they, any curiosity? I mean, you know, you do intellectual work for a living, and they do all kinds of work, so you wouldn't necessarily run across them. But did you ever encounter that kind of curiosity?
Yeah, certainly. Just a month ago, I had some visitors that were house guests for 3 days from Lake Charles, Tea Party Trump supporters, a single mom and her two children. And we had a wonderful time. And in the course of the visit, we did what's called a living room conversation. You get left and right together. This is an idea that's established by Joan Cole, by Joan Blades, who is the co-founder of MoveOn.org. She's a mediation lawyer. And so we were in our living room, and the task was, can we find common ground on cleaning up the environment? Could that be a crossover issue for us? And so at the end of the visit, this guest, her name was Sharon Galicia, said, hey, I'm going to go back to Lake Charles and start a living room conversation back there. And her son said, yeah, in my school, he was editor of his high school newspaper, I'm going to do a column on pollution in Lake Charles. So, yeah, and you wouldn't believe my email. I had a group, a woman who said, well, I'm a member of Episcopal Church in Massachusetts. I'd like to team up with a church in Lake Charles. Could you put me in touch? There's a lot of this going on. I've been back several times. Once I brought my son. And this book is being used as a shared read at Louisiana State University. So all freshmen will be reading it. I'll go back at the end of August to talk to them about it. So yeah, I mean to open a conversation, you know, and have them get to know about us as we do about them. Yeah.
Well, that is going to have to wrap up our show. Thanks again to Arlie Russell Hochschild for joining us. Once again, she is the author of a terrific and important new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, which is out with the New Press and available everywhere. Sam and I urge you to get it and have a read. Arlie, thank you for joining our show.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And thanks to everyone else for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.